don't know if any of you have been on those lifts for the London Underground, the ones about take about 60 and take you right down to the bowels of London. Has everyone been on those huge lifts? Well, I have an almost uncontrollable urge to say, guys, you probably wonder why I've gathered you all here, but, okay, that's, now, Sandy doesn't share that. Sandy, that isn't even on her radar. She's not even thinking anything like that sort of thing, and I'm trying to suppress an urge. We're very different. As a coach, this time of year in Kenya, this is when the rugby season starts. If I see a tall second row forward at the beginning of a training session practicing drop kicks or any kicking, I will give him a roasting. That is not what I want him on the team for. If he's warming up, he needs to be warming up to the job that he will do on the team that I'm creating. If I see a scrum half doing anything other than passing practice, now for those of you who aren't rugby players, you won't understand the passion behind this, but if they're practicing for a role that they're not going to perform, they will get a serious dressing down. A serious dressing down. The simple point being, within a church, this church, we are all different for the specific reason, or a specific reason, amongst many, that we are called to different people. The appeal that you have will be different from the appeal that I have. The way that you talk about Jesus will be different from my own. In the book of Daniel, I don't know why they kicked up a fuss about the whole vegetarian meat thing when they were quite happy, Daniel and his mates, to have their names changed to "I'll serve whatever God you want to put in my name." Why did they not kick up a fuss about that? We're not told. We're not close enough to that situation to understand why they actually made a fuss about one thing and not another. I don't know your situation and you don't know mine, and this evening I'm not here to tell you how to talk about Jesus in your situation, because I'm not in it. I don't make the same appeal or have the same appeal that you have. So what on earth are we here for? Talking about Jesus, as Denver very neatly put it, it's in the series of All About Jesus. For those who didn't spot it, he wove that in very nicely. So the overall theme, what I'd like to say is, you should listen, I should listen. Don't assume that if somebody says one thing, they mean another. Listen a bit more. And when an opportunity comes, don't duck. So listen, don't assume, don't duck. They say I'm a Catholic, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Baha'i priest. Don't assume that means, find out what it means to them. And don't duck when the opportunity comes. Acts 17, Paul on Mars Hill. That's not the first thing he does. He spent a long time going around the city, and then on Mars Hill, Acts 17. You're the unknown God. I am now going to declare to you. He had done his research. He had done his listening. The opportunity came. He didn't duck. The Christian slant, let me say, is not an altogether welcome angle on a discussion, or on any discussion. A chap named David Robinson has written this book, The Dawkins Letters, where he's written to Dawkins in response to the God Delusion book that Dawkins wrote. And I like him. I like him for the very specific reason. He's included in here atheist comments on the content of these letters that were first published on that website. His name's David Robinson. Robertson is a prat, and not only a prat, but a dangerous prat, a complete loser. Someone else writes about Robertson. I'm impressed that some of the people here bother to debate this Robinson nincompoop. He's clearly out of his mind and beyond reason and logic. I like him because he's actually published that at the front of the book which he created from the letters he wrote. That is the sort of welcome you receive if you want to put a Christian angle on something. You're a loser, you're a prat, you're a nincompoop. And can I just say, for the sake of you all here, there's no harder place to be a nincompoop or a loser or a prat than in a science classroom when the biology teacher or science teacher is telling you the theory of evolution. All right, it takes a great deal of courage for our young people to stand up for what they believe might be an alternative viewpoint. But we all know in any discussion, by the way, that's a great book, a very easy, very readable book, written by a minister, so it can't be that tricky to understand. He's writing about science things, so it's got to be fairly... So I don't mean that at all. Well, actually, I do. You're an Everton supporter. What I'd like to do very briefly tonight, Christianity is based on truth. It's got a backbone. It's got a very solid foundation. If you're bamboozled by discussion, come away from discussion thinking, couldn't think quickly enough to say so-and-so, or blown away by an argument. Your faith, my faith, our faith, has a backbone. Happy feelings, enjoyable worship, being moved, that's not enough to sustain your faith, I'm afraid. It's got its place, it's good, it's right. I was lucky enough to be at Word Alive with the Gettys, who were leading the worship, the people who write a lot of the songs that we sing. Excellent, love being a part of a huge congregation. But that's not the whole thing. It is experiential. It has to be. We claim a relationship with God. But it's more substantial than feelings alone. But if you want to share your faith, you must be convinced of your faith. I must be convinced that it's not a simplistic leap in the dark, hoping for the best, that amongst all the religions on offer, I happen to have been lucky enough to have chanced upon the right one. We're close to Easter. We'll be looking a little bit at what I've chose to term a scandal. We'll see that in a moment. But the resurrection is central to our belief as Christians. Paul writes here in Corinthians, he says, if you're going to doubt your faith, then please doubt properly. Go all the way with your doubt. Don't dilly-dally about it. Go all the way. And for his money, he said, the resurrection, and for the Christian faith as a whole, for our money, the resurrection is where it stands or falls. If there's no resurrection, there is no faith. He writes there at the bottom, if only for this life we have hope in Christ, we're to be pitied more than all men. If there's no resurrection, forget it. Your faith is of no worth. Christ had to die to deal with our sins, but in order to conquer death and to prove that he was God, he had to rise again, fulfilled Old Testament prophecy. Christianity stands or falls by this. If Jesus has risen from the dead, we need to take him seriously. Our friends need to take him seriously. Their destiny, humanly speaking, is in our hands. We must pray for them. We must share our faith with them. Not just live alongside them, hoping that by telepathy they'll somehow hear the gospel. It doesn't work in my marriage, telepathy. It certainly won't work in any other relationship that is not as close. Right? They don't discuss that in a page group, but something you could discuss in another group. I tell you, telepathy, it doesn't work in any friendship within a church. Doesn't work outside the church either. What he says about me and my friends, sinful, need to be saved. Destiny, heaven, or hell. So how can Christians be so sure of their faith? Because, let me say, for guys outside the church, talking about Jesus is a scandal. It's not politically correct. It's got dogma. Things that are right, things that are wrong. If Jesus hadn't risen from the dead, we're promulgating a scandal. The whole gospel is a lie. And the church is a hoax. Very, very briefly, though, there is sound documentation for the resurrection. Six main witnesses, four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, then, and Peter, as well as the whole primitive church. Paul wrote his first letter to Corinthians 25 years after the event. Mark represents Peter's oral teaching, was written about 44 AD, about 15 years after the event. Luke, known to be an excellent historian. There is sound documentation. There's changed lives in the early church. It didn't just provide the church with high moral and ethical teaching. It was lived out. There were changed lives, not just changed thinking. The way they did things, cowards like Peter, the denying guy, then speaking out on the day of Pentecost. If it was just a lie, somebody at some time would have broken, would have cracked under it all. The accounts are believable. They're believable because they were not, at that time, politically correct, as it happens. Women. Women being the first witnesses, that's not how you get credibility for your message. But actually, over time, it becomes very, very credible. The accounts in the Gospels agree with each other. There was no body found. Well, perhaps the disciples stole the body. Well, fraud of that nature could not have withstood the persecution that followed. But not even a whisper has been heard within the church of stealing the body. Perhaps the authorities stole the body. Why? For what reason? Good way to squash the whole Jesus has risen again was just to wheel him out in a barrow and say, well, actually, no, he's not. This is his decaying body. He is dead and remains dead. Perhaps they went to the wrong tomb. Well, we could go down that one for a long while. There's a huge loopholes in that argument. There is simply too much corroborating eyewitness account. The death of Jesus was real. At the end of the 18th century, a chap by the name of, and I can never pronounce this correctly, it's too Italian sounding, Venturini. He suggested, you'll be familiar with the notion of Jesus swooning on the cross, reviving again in the cool of the tomb, pushing back a rock that people were worried about, a group of them being able to move, that was sealed. 3 days without food and water, he would have had to have first got away from his spice-laden clothes, about 75 pounds worth weight of stuff ladening him down and tightly binding his body. And then after rolling the stone away, terrifying the gods, walk miles on foot and declare himself risen. It's a little unlikely. They're the appearances of Jesus. Again, being knocked as hallucinations. Well, certain types of people tend towards experiences. I'm not going to go into types because then you can tie me up in about what I should or shouldn't be saying here. But all 500 people, he made an appearance to 500 people in one go at the same time. Chances of 500 being similarly prone to hallucination. People are being cynical. They may say the psychic Mary, but the cynical tax collector Matthew in the same crowd. And they were unexpected. They weren't looking for these appearances. They were surprised by the resurrection. They weren't in a room chanting together, expecting Jesus will appear if they could work themselves up. It was a surprise for them. They were sad and defeated. That's the sort of entree that Jesus had. And they weren't just at one time of day or night in the right sort of feel for a meeting. There's the early morning tomb, in the evening in the upper room, afternoon's walk in the country, after a morning's fishing. All sorts of days, all sorts of settings. That and the hallucinations, if that's what they were, would have decreased gradually over time. But there were 40 days and then stopped. There were no more. It was planned. There would be 40 days and then that's the end of those things. Or perhaps, actually, his spirit had returned to his body. It was recognisable, although being a risen body. Perhaps it had been gloriously changed. Perhaps the account in the Gospels is correct. And then, there's a living testimony of the church today. Sustained growth over the centuries. So the resurrection, and you can go and read these things, you can get books and read them again for yourself. But we're not making these things up. Your faith can be childlike, but your thinking can be mature and adult. It can be scientific. It can be literary.
talking about Jesus thing. It's not made up.
But there are actually two questions. The first one, is it true? Fine. But the one, as I've mentioned before, is does it work? Does it make a difference to your life? And in actual fact, that's the question that people ask first. Does it work? And you may or may not have noticed, being artistic on this one, it's in different colours. The multicoloured appeal that we make as a church. If it's working in your life, people investigate it further. When I went to work at Henley and Arden School, great place to be. I had a forerunner, highly respected person, who had come and spoken at the school many, many times and made the Christian faith incredible. Bob Telford. They had a high regard for Saltisford and what the Christian faith meant. Means, present tense. He'd been speaking regularly at that school in assemblies right through the death of his own son, David, and was open about who he was. He does his sharing of faith differently from me. John Ayrton summed up very nicely, said, God does not call you to be something you are not. He simply calls you to be open about what you are. He doesn't call you to be something you are not, but to be open about what or who you are. This last week, I found out two girls in my group at Holiday Club, they live on my street. I've never met them in my life because they're at the other end of the street and we access our street from two ends and never met. They were happy to come along. They were happy to meet me because they already knew Anne Morse, same church, already a credible witness. So in talking about Jesus, it's not just dependent on you. You might be the link in the chain. There may be a brother, a cousin, a sister, a parent who is praying for their son, daughter, uncle, aunt, whatever, to come across somebody in the work situation, as a neighbour, in the bus queue, in the queue at Sainsbury's or Tesco, or whatever it is. And you may be the answer to someone's prayer on the other side of the world. Each will live out our Christian faith in a different way. But we're all called to be disciples. We're all called to be open about being disciples. There's a cross representing Jesus. There's someone who doesn't know Jesus. Very, very simple question. Is your life, is my life, and the things that I say, bringing them closer or pushing them further away from Jesus? Very simple. Is my life, coupled with the things that I say, bringing someone closer to Jesus and outside of further away from Jesus? Good place to practice this? In the church. Have the courage to bring up the sermon from the Sunday morning at the lunchtime meal table. To pray before we wave goodbye to each other at the end of an evening. Just socialising. Bring Christ into our lives within the church, just into conversation more. Get used to that and then take it on into the workplace, into the neighbourhood. Pray for opportunities to witness, but be sure you pray for the courage to take the opportunity when it comes along. I was driving back from Exeter one time as a student, whichever year it was, I can't remember. Picked up a hitchhiker, generally picked them up to keep me awake, chatting about it. Chatting. So he managed to wheedle out of me between Exeter by the time we got halfway to Bristol. He'd wheedle out at me that I was a Christian, I was an evangelical Christian, and he came out with a classic line, said, you know, you're the fourth evangelical Christian who's picked me up in a row. Do you think God's trying to tell me something? I think, oh, yeah, okay, that's my... They don't come along like that very often. More often than not, you might be the link in the chain, I might be the link in the chain. Paul was very careful not to assume anything about his audience in Acts. At Athens. Listen. Don't assume. listen some more. But don't duck either when the opportunity comes along.